Saturday, November 26th, 1994. I am interviewing Guy Powell. This is Paula Schwartz. Okay, Guy, I am in his home now on West Kuskoff?
1219 Kuskoff.
Kuskoff. Oh, Geneva's is West Kuskoff. They can see this on tape? This? Anyway, Guy, I'm just going to ask you a few questions about your experience here in Alaska, and you just feel free to just give me all the detail or as little detail as you would like. In typical Guy Powell fashion, I've heard a lot of very colorful things about you from Len this evening, as a matter of fact. Okay. First of all, Guy, where were you born?
I was born in Ridgewood, New Jersey.
Ridgewood, New Jersey. And how did you somehow end up all the way up here?
New Jersey.
New Jersey.
Well, I migrated to Colorado. And even in Colorado, there were too many no hunting and no trespassing signs. So it seemed logical to migrate further west to get away from all those signs and red lights and horns beeping.
How old were you when you went to Colorado?
Well, my mother moved to Colorado, and so when I graduated from, well, even before I graduated from high school, I was making trips out there. But I went to Colorado Aggies for my master's degree, and that would have been in 1955, I guess, after I graduated from high school.
Well, wait, you did your master's in Colorado, you just said?
That's correct.
Okay, where was your undergraduate work done?
In New Jersey.
New Jersey?
Rutgers University.
Oh, Rutgers, Linois. I graduated from Rutgers, yeah. So, a master's in agriculture, Aggie?
Fisheries.
Undergraduate work in what?
Fisheries. It was wildlife conservation, but most all the work I did was in fisheries.
Now, Guy, how coming out of New Jersey to be involved in fisheries was kind of a different sort of thing on the East Coast. What, do you think that you were born with that desire or something? Where did that come from?
Oh, no, New Jersey is just covered with lakes. And, of course, you know, kids growing up in New Jersey, they go down to the local pond and catch sunfish. And
see, I guess I think more Manhattan, New York, New Jersey, that kind of New Jersey, rather than the New Jersey that...
There's a lot of streams and small rivers and creeks, and it's very productive, and fish grow to be quite a large size. Mm-hmm. And of course there's a lot of difference, you know, from East Jersey and West mm-hmm. Jersey and mm-hmm. South Jersey. Mm-hmm. But I always seem to prefer to spend my time in the woods and in the fields. And
so did you have a dream like Lynn did of living like a wild Indian and coming up to Alaska? Is that what brought you up here?
No, I never had any of those ideas. Never really, I always like to, whatever I did, I always wanted somebody with me. Experience not shared is just an experience not enjoyed.
Okay, so how did you put that into effect when you when you came here? Was Merle in the picture?
Well, no, I mean, just as far as you said living as a wild man,
well,
you know.
Well, Len's thing was to come to Alaska and live like an Indian. Live wild like an Indian. That's what he always told me, you know, coming to, that's what prompted him to come.
Well, no, when I came, of course, I came to an accept a job with the Territory of Alaska Fish and Game Department. And so it happened to be in Kodiak. And so...
Was this your first job right out of school?
Right out of school. I started receiving my pay in Colorado.
Huh.
As I drove up the Alcan, I was being paid.
Now, when was that guy? That was, you said
1958. Yeah. I didn't even graduate. Graduation, I think, was in May or so.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted me to come right away.
And so you came to Kodiak?
So I drove up to Kodiak.
Working for Fish and Game right down here?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Wow,
and never left, stayed here the whole time.
Wow, I didn't know that. So what was your first position?
King Crab Research. And I stayed with King Crab the whole time.
Yeah, now Lynn told me, now I was unaware of this too, that you basically came to start that whole fisheries. And basically you were here right to the end of it. And he outlined those years as 55 to 80, what he gave me, 83?
No, it's not true, actually. There was Ed Heiser was here before I was, and a guy named Reed Stevens. And admittedly, they were here for, you know, just a short while.
Mm-hmm.
And good night in those days, you almost had to work a year just to get to know your way around. It was...
So was it an established fisheries by the time you got here? Because I was under the impression that you basically established it, began the research on it.
Okay, well, when you mentioned fisheries, really the biologist doesn't have too much to do with starting a fishery or manipulating it or keeping it going. That's pretty much dependent on the individuals investing in it.
Mm-hmm.
And other fisheries and diversifying and these types of things, plus the population of the animals and...
Mm-hmm.
Ability to go out and catch them and harvest them. But it seemed like the king crab fishery was going to grow. And I'm sure it probably had something to do with the Wakefields. Wakefields were very instrumental in pioneering. I would say if anybody pioneered the king crab fishery, it'd be the Wakefields.
Who were the Wakefields?
Lowell Wakefield and his dad and Howard Wakefield. They were basically processors. But for years they advertised in Life magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And beautiful big ads. And I'm sure people all over the world got to know about king crab through those advertisements. But... there was very, very, very little known about king crab. And so our first commissioner, Clarence Anderson, I guess he was the person that I corresponded with initially. And they needed somebody to, the first need they had was to study the growth and age. Nobody knew how fast they grew and to what age they lived. So that was the first thing that happened when I came here, is they wanted me to study the growth and the age. And the federal government had actually made money available to the department through a grant, Salt and Stahl Kennedy grant, to study the king crab.
Oh, so that was your first task coming on board?
I would say that was the primary goal.
Yeah. Guy, when you first came to Kodiak, was there any commercial fishing for king crab at the time?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there was what you'd call small fishery, small boats. Of course, that's relative, small boats, but they were little salmon seiners. In fact, the boats that fish salmon in the summer would fish king crab later on after salmon season closed.
What was the season for king
crab? Well, in those days, the season was just almost 12 months of the year. And there were a lot of old shell skip molt crabs, so it was possible to, right after the molt and during the molt, that they could pick through the new crab and pick out the old shells. But it didn't take too long before we closed it during the mating season and the molting season. And then gradually it became a winter fishery at the time when the crabs were full of meat.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's the largest crab that you ever saw?
Well, the largest crab in the world that was ever weighed, and we always went by weight, was 24 pounds 6 ounces, and it came in on a tender, and Emil Norton called me, and some of his crew had found it down there, and so we went down and weighed it. It was 24 pounds 6 ounces.
Wow.
They never found a crab that would measure 6 feet across. They were always looking for a crab that goes 6 foot, from tip of leg to tip of leg. But it seemed like the heavier ones were stockier, so they weren't as long.
Mm-hmm. Now, explain to me what a typical day would have been like for you, your responsibilities in that position.
Typical day, no such thing as a typical day, but since I was a bachelor initially, I would work 7 days a week and 14, 18 hours a day. Whenever a fishing boat came into town, I would go aboard the boat and I'd talk to the captain and I would just learn just as much as I could about his fishing, his trip, what he caught, where he fished, how deep, whatever. And as a result, I got to know almost all the captains and all the deckhands, and it worked out really neat because they were real interested in the results of our work, and so I could share it with them eyeball to eyeball, person to person. And so the fishermen were intimately involved with the research program, and they had a personal interest in it.
Is that something that you saw increase or wane over time?
No, we always, in order to manage a fishery, you have to have good data. And it has to be accurate. And what better person to obtain that data from than the fishermen, the captain themselves? And now they have the observer program, where they actually have paid people aboard most every ship.
Oh, do they?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
And I think part of the reason is, if you don't maintain a real close personal relationship with each captain, you're not going to get your information. I mean, just picture, here's a stranger walking down to the boat, and he wants to know where you fished and what you caught and how much effort you gave into it. Well, he doesn't want to tell that guy the truth, because next year that guy might be captain of a fishing boat. And so it got to the point where they don't want to give their secrets away.
Mm-hmm.
But for many years, it was real personal. But as the town grew and the fleet grew, you know, things changed.
How many in that fleet initially?
Oh boy. Initially, you know, it started off with one boat and then gradually grew, and you know, some months you might only have two or three. And but when I got here in 58, if I guessed, maybe there were 20 boats. 20 boats that caught 90% of the crab. Mm-hmm.
Now, when did you retire?
I don't even know when I retired. That's a funny question. I don't even know. This is 1994. If I've been retired for 10 years, I retired in 84. We'll have to ask my wife. I think it's been close to 10 years.
Okay, what were the, since obviously you were there for a long period of time, you saw the crab industry come to an end in the mid-80s, was it, Guy?
Well, it was just about the time I retired, so I would say it was probably right around 84.
Okay, you obviously saw changes, differences in that time frame. Can you outline for me some of the major changes that you observed, or some of the things that were the most meaningful for that fishery over time?
Well, let's see. Of course, the change was incredible, because initially there was no fishery at all. There was no knowledge of king crab.
Yeah, let me move this closer for you.
In fact,
there. Okay, go ahead.
The question that always comes up is, historically, how long have king crabs inhabited the waters around Kodiak Island, let's say? Or how long have king crabs been in and around Alaskan waters? And the first thought, natural thought, is, well, if you look in the midden sites of the ancient people, you know, the people that lived here 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, however long ago, you'd find pieces of king crab just like you do. You find codfish otoliths, and you find spines from sea urchins and fish bones and bird bones. But to my knowledge, there has never been a piece of a king crab ever found in any archaeological dig in the history of Alaska. Well, that would tend to indicate that the native peoples never were able to either catch crab, or else there were no crabs around. And that doesn't sound natural, that they wouldn't be able to catch them, because there are times of the year when they're shallow and they should be able to reach down and get them with mm-hmm. a stick or something. But then I've heard people say, well, they were superstitious, and they would never touch or eat a crab. Well, I don't know if that's true, see.
Meaning.
But then when you talk to the earliest fishermen that fished around Kodiak, the halibut fishermen, they never caught king crab, never. And I had a guy tell me one day, I think he was fishing somewhere off Portlock Banks, he brought up this great big crab on one of his halibut hooks. He had never seen anything like it before, and he was on the radio and telling people, trying to find out what it was that he caught. And it was a king crab. Well, it wasn't many years later that every single halibut fisherman was catching king crab. In fact, the king crab was so abundant that it was hard for the halibut fishermen to catch a halibut, because when the gear hit the bottom, the crab would run over and grab the bait. So there's a lot of evidence to show that the king crab population just exploded, you know, from almost nothing to a real rich fishery. But like so many things, when you're dealing with ocean resources, things happen so quickly, you know, 20, 30 years is quick. And by the time you get organized, it's over, you know, so we'll never know. Now, one thing that might help is if the king crab population comes back again and it's as important and rich as it was during the peak years, 65, 66, then that might give us some insight into, the cyclic nature. But it certainly seems to have gone up, increasing rapidly and then decreasing rapidly.
Mm-hmm. Do you miss being involved in that, Frank?
Well, not really. When I was going to college, particularly back in Rutgers, a lot of my professors were old men, mm-hmm. and they were devoting their life to teaching. And that was their whole life. And I'm sure that I would have, I would have stayed on and worked until I was 80 years old. But the politics and the governmental red tape just destroys it, really. The way the department was organized, I think the two divisions, you had research division and management division. Mm-hmm. And what that required was your management biologist had to read all the research reports and learn all about the king crab after the research was done, and then they would take that information and use it to manage the resource. Mm-hmm. Very awkward, clumsy method as far as I'm concerned. The best years were the years when the management biologists would work real close with the research biologists. Mm-hmm. And if you're working 365 days a year off and on and long days, whatever, it's hard for you to tell everything you know to some guy that
right.
that wants to know what you're doing in his spare time, because he's busy with other things.
Right. But that's how it is today.
And so you have guys in charge of managing a fishery. Maybe they've been there for 1 or 2 years, and the research guy, maybe he's been there for 20 years. And the guy that's in the research position has really no say in it.
Right.
Very
little.
He's
really been intimately involved with the fishery.
Yeah. And it's we tried to reorganize. There were several attempts to reorganize the department into teams where you'd have a king crab team,
mm-hmm.
and the responsibility for that team would be to study and manage the fishery rather than having a research group and a management group. Without regard to individual fisheries, have a salmon team and have a...
You're saying a blended team rather than a distinct management.
Like your research team, you'd have management people and research people.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe in some teams, the head guy would be in research only because he's been there longer.
Mm-hmm.
In other cases, a management man might be the leader of the team. Dependent on his ability and experience.
Now, how big was fishing game at the time? How many employees?
That's interesting.
There when you first.
There was a territory,
mm-hmm.
and in Kodiak. Oh boy, how many employees? Roy Rickey was here. Seems like just Roy Rickey and myself, two guys.
Get out. Comprised all. No, I'm saying all of.
Well, all of Fish and Game in Kodiak.
All of Fish and Game in Kodiak.
Roy Rickey and myself. And there must have been a secretary. Gladys Lindbergh, Goddess Buell, she might have been here. And then it started growing. Sport fish biologist Bob Simon came pretty soon. But the entire department, I don't think the entire fish and game department had more than 14 people.
Wow.
In it.
Wow.
Seems like. You see, it was a territory, and so supposedly the federal government was supposed to be taking care of the fisheries. But there were in the early years, there was more Russians fishing off Kodiak than there were Americans. Seems like a whole fleet of Japanese.
Oh, that's right. Well, they're. Sure.
I mean, Russian
sure.
Factory ships, tangle net fisheries, were fishing right off the south end of the island. That was a major problem for years. The foreign fleets fishing.
Give me a little more on that guy. Tell me a little more about that.
Well, the part I'm most familiar with is the Creatures of the Continental Shelf Convention, which was a part of the Geneva Convention. And it dealt with animals that live on and in constant contact with the ocean floor. So that would exclude salmon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, like all of your anadromous fish, like salmon, the treaties would have to be negotiated and worked out in meetings. But what happened at the Geneva Convention was they had what they called creatures of the continental shelf. And so any animal that lived on the continental shelf, which was defined, I think, as what, 109 fowls, I think, belonged to the contiguous nation. And so when that was finally passed, that said that all king crabs were the property of the United States. And where Alaska is across from Russia,
mm-hmm.
where Russia would own out to the midpoint, and the United States would own out to the midpoint. And so that really helped. Because trying to manage a fishery that's available for harvest to any nation in the world is just total chaos. And so, I don't remember the exact year when that took place, but that was one of the neatest things that happened. And then you had the 12-mile limit, which helped. Also, that just meant that no foreign nation could come inside the 12-mile limit and fish.
Mm-hmm.
So all fish species within that 12-mile limit were to be harvested only by the nation contiguous to it. But there was a while there where, and the early fleets were drag fleets and tangle net fleets. So all your king crabs were harvested tangle nets and trawls.
Mm-hmm.
And trawling was extremely damaging, if you know anything about trawling. And even tangle nets were damaging insofar as it took both sexes, females, males.
Mm-hmm.
Now they did have large mesh, so if they were fishing correctly, the smaller crabs could pass through the net. And I think that was one of the things that the fishery biologists over time were able to get the fishery to convert entirely to pots. The only damage pots do really would be when a pot lands on the bottom of the ocean, it might land on top of a crab or two and could perhaps damage a crab, or if a line breaks, then the crab pot is on the bottom of the ocean. But catching crabs even. But you're not really, you're not into the history of the fishery and all that.
Well, I'm not. What I want to know is, did many Russian ships ever come in here into Kodiak? Did you have much contact with any Russian captains of ships that came in? Did that ever happen?
No, the Russians, during the years they were harvesting the king crabs, never came to Kodiak. I don't think they were allowed to, but I had far more contact with Japanese scientists. In fact, I think the first king crab research report ever written was in 1933 by a Japanese biologist over in around Hokkaido. Marikawa was his name. But we would try to write back and forth and compare work and mm-hmm. learn from one another. Mm-hmm. But Kodiak was kind of a lonely outpost. And
yeah, it must have been back then. Come on, you can come in.
There were really very few people. That was really a big disadvantage. It's difficult, you know, if you're working on a research program and there's six or seven or eight other guys involved in different aspects of it,
mm-hmm.
you can get together and share and talk and learn from one another.
Mm-hmm.
But for quite a few years, I was the only guy in Alaska with fish and game,
mm-hmm.
and then the federal biologist started working in the Bering Sea. But that was difficult, and there weren't too many other, lobsters would be about the closest. I found by studying the lobster fishery, the history of the fishery, and the growth of the lobster, and migrations, and all these types of things, that you could learn a great deal from what they had done. And that was helpful in my work with the king crab.
Now, guys, you saw more people added to the department. You saw the bureaucracy kind of grow. Did that interfere with your position or any of your work, or did you have any adjustments to make with additional staff coming on board?
No, not really. Kodiak was pretty much by itself. Fisheries grew up in Cook Inlet, fisheries grew up in Southeastern, fisheries grew up out on the peninsula and out on the Aleutian chain. And as they grew, frequently I'd be, you know, asked to help. Frequently the guys involved with those fisheries would come to Kodiak and talk to me, and frequently I'd fly down and help them on a tagging program or something. Probably the biggest change was as the fisheries grew out the Aleutian Peninsula and the Aleutian chain, the work I was doing in Kodiak expanded out the chain,
mm-hmm.
out into the Aleutians. And we started, I don't know when it was, 19, good night. 61, it couldn't have been 61. 71, maybe it was 71. We started population surveys, chartering vessels. Normally the boat would cost us $1,000 a day. And we chartered a boat for 40 days. So, you know, $40,000 charter, that's just for the boat. And we'd go out and fish and study populations. Well, those programs kept spreading west. And they even spread up into Norton Sound off the coast of Nome.
Mm-hmm.
We found out that by going and fishing in the ocean, according to a statistically random sample, stratified random sample, you could come up with a population estimate and we'd fish, and then we'd tag crabs and liberate the tag crabs. And then the commercial fishery would open and they would recapture the tag crabs. And so we were able to get estimates of the fishing mortality, which is really crucial. Not only how many crab live out in the ocean, but when the fishermen go out there, what percent of them do they catch? You know, do they catch half of them, or 80% of them, or just 10% of them?
I heard that you had some good jokes played on you by some of the fishermen dropping their tagged crabs into others. Len, what was that, into others' pots on another vessel?
Well, jokes. Actually, the patterns were so clear. You know, if a fisherman held his chart upside down,
mm-hmm.
and when you asked him where'd you catch his tag, you know, he'd point to the north end, and you know you tagged it in the south end. You knew that he wasn't telling the truth. And every time I talked to a captain, one of the questions I'd ask is, who's fishing right next to you? I mean, you're in a really good fishing, so somebody must be fishing just north of you or east of you. And so the guy would say, oh yeah, Oscar Dyson's right next to me here, and so-and-so's over here on the left. Well, then I would know. Well, then I'd interview Oscar Dyson maybe the next day or two, 3 days and ask him, where are you fishing? Well, if he tells me he's fishing up off of Tonki, and a guy just told me that he was down off of Sitkanak, I was able to tell whether or not guys were, you know, lying to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I had so many friends. I had a Norwegian friend fishing on a boat, and I went and asked the skipper, you catching any tags? He says, no. They had about 23 tag crabs. And the Norwegian guy called me up and anonymously and said, if you go and you open the kitchen cupboard, you know, up on the left, there's a Worcestershire bottle there, and on the neck of that Worcestershire bottle, there's 23 tags. So I went down on the boat and opened up that cupboard, make them believe I was looking for a coffee cup, and found all those tags and called the captain a liar. And he knew he was, and he didn't throw me off the boat or anything. So, but I mean, if you make a lot of friends and you're working hard and you're doing the best job you can, people respect that,
mm-hmm.
and they help you out.
All right, hold here. Okay, you have a pretty good memory, guy. So maybe you can tell me who some of the people were that were involved in the early fleet and what that fleet was like, and how much those fishermen made or were paid. Can you give me some background on that?
If you really needed, you know, there's enough of that information in the files, really.
I'm not going to the files.
I can remember Al Fenner, his wife Mabel Fenner was the, what was she? She was the highest law magistrate. Mabel
mm-hmm.
Fenner was a magistrate, and Al Fenner had this little boat, and he would go out and he'd come in and cook the crabs in a bucket or something, and he'd stand on a corner and sell them.
Huh.
And it almost seems to me like he would get a dollar a piece for them or something.
Like the street vendors in Manhattan.
And then 20 years later, they were worth $100 a piece.
Mm.
But, you know, Lloyd Cannon, he was one of the early fishermen. And but to sit down and try to bring names out of my mind, memory.
Are any of these guys still around?
Oh yeah, Lloyd Cannon, yeah, he's the president of All Alaskan Seafoods, a very large processor and Oscar Dyson and Selden Nelson, they're still around. Yeah, there's a lot of them still around. A lot of them are gone. A lot of them just fished for a few years. John Lukey, he had a little boat, the Barracuda. And he never chose to get a bigger boat. There's the guy with the Popeye. Walt Erickson, I think he's still down in Old Harbor. He just fished with his little tiny boat and never chose to get a larger boat. But you know, as years went on, they got into multi-million dollar boats, mm-hmm. 140, 60 mm-hmm. feet. Some of these boats, you know, they could only carry five small pots or so, and now they carry 300 pots and great big ones. But Wayne Murphy, he disappeared at sea years ago. He had the Western.
Not Wayne Murphy.
Wayne, did I say Wayne Murphy? I didn't mean Wayne Murphy. I forget. Western Murphy. Murphy, what was his name?
Well, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. I just wanted to get a feeling for what that early fleet was like, just a little more detail in terms of that.
It'd make a really neat, to me, it'd make a neat book if someone had a picture of the boats and maybe a picture of the captain, and just show the men in the ships, you know, that started and pioneered some of these fisheries.
There you go.
But
there's a project for you. In the 5 spare minutes a day that you have.
Yeah, right.
Now, Guy, I know you were not around, you were out of town during the tsunami, but I know that's a big deal here in terms of people's experience with that. So could you describe for me, oh, you blew the bubble, Lenny just blew the bubble. Len told me about that too. Can you describe the days surrounding that for me and your experience with that?
Well, I can tell you a story about that. By that time, I was married, and I owned the home that I'm sitting in right now with you, and my wife was pregnant with our first child, and my daughter was born in May, and of course the tidal wave was in March, so she must have been about 7 months pregnant. Mm-hmm. And I had to go to Seattle on official business to visit with the owner of Floyd Tag Manufacturing Company. He was developing some king crab tags for us. And I was actually in his home. But that day we decided to go play a little golf. It was a weekend, I believe. It'd be easy to find out whether it was a weekend or not. But I can remember when it came over the radio, the news people were actually shouting and yelling, and they were saying that the island had sunk and nobody'd heard from anybody on Kodiak, and it was just total hysteria. Very, very unprofessional, really. I often wondered how it got so
you would think far they would
from
have kept
factual.
The emotion
but the first thing I did was I called Merle's mother.
Mm-hmm.
No, I didn't call her. I wrote her a telegram. First thing I did is I went right to Western Union, wrote a telegram, said, "Mr. and Mrs. Garrett, Merle is fine. Don't worry." And I'll never forget, because about 8 years later, we're down in Louisiana and we're all seated around a table visiting, and Mrs. Garrett said, "Oh, I'm so happy that you sent me that telegram." She said, "We never worried a bit, and all these other people were so worried." And she says, "Where were you, Guy, when the tidal wave hit Kodiak?" I said, "Oh, I was in Seattle playing golf." And she looked at me and her mouth open. "Well, how did you know Merle was okay?" she said. I said, "Well, if she was home where she belonged, she'd have to be okay, because we live up on a big cliff." Wow. She really seemed disappointed.
No kidding.
All that time, she could have been worrying. And but I came back to town on the first commercial flight. I think I was the only person on the plane that wasn't with the press.
Wow.
And the guy flying the plane just flew in circles right over Kodiak while all these press people were hanging out the windows taking pictures mm-hmm. with their cameras, mm-hmm. you know.
Now, how soon after was that?
Well, I immediately went to the airport there in Seattle, SeaTac, and tried to book a flight right back to Alaska. In fact, I went out on a field. I can remember this. There was a couple of stewardesses that I knew that got off the plane, and they were telling stories. They were surrounded by press. You know, 10 guys would surround this one stewardess, and she was telling them about her experiences. She went up in the top of the Anchorage Westward Hotel when the earthquake struck, and the elevators lost power. She had to walk, 14 stories? She had to walk 14 stories down to the ground floor mm-hmm. in the dark. And I guess the two buildings were moving back and forth enough that they would hit each other.
Oh, I heard that.
But I can remember when these gals got off the plane and they were telling these stories to all these reporters. And everybody was leaving Alaska, and I was trying to get back. But it was pretty chaotic.
Now, you took those pictures of the Westmark that are